1968, he warned that the Earth's population was out of control and there wasn't much time to waste. Already, he said, human inaction had caused the premature deaths of hundreds of millions of people to hunger and to disease. On this edition of Conversations, we talked to the man who wrote The Population Bomb. That was that first warning in 1968. A good many books since then, and most recently, The Population Explosion. He is biologist Paul Ehrlich. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Good. I'm glad to know it. In The Population Explosion, you gave a couple of illustrations, and I wonder if we can begin with them as foundation laying. Here's the note. In 1968, there were 3.5 billion people on the planet. Now there are well over 5 billion. The phrase that I want you to look at is exponential growth. You gave two nice illustrations. One was an interest-bearing bank account to illustrate it, and the other one was weeds in a pond. Can you lead us into overpopulation through that door?
Exponential growth does work like a bank account in the sense that if you have a bank account with compound interest, when you earn some interest, it goes into the principal, and then the next interest is earned on the previous principal plus the interest. And same thing roughly with any population that's growing. The children that you add to the population, you think of them as the interest, mm-hmm. then themselves contribute more children in the next generation, and so the population grows exponentially. That is that there is it grows as a portion of itself all the time, and that means you get a population size that grows like that. Big curve gets steeper and steeper. And the story with the pondweed is to illustrate one of the important features of exponential growth. Again, it's not exactly exponential, but it's close enough for government work. And that is, suppose you put some weed into a pond and you know that it's going to double the area of the pond that it covers every day, so that in 30 days, the entire pond is covered with weeds. Mm-hmm. So you've put some weed in, it's going to double its area covered every day for 30 days, and after 30 days, the pond will be entirely covered. Then you ask somebody the question, well, how much of the pond is going to be covered on the 29th day? And the answer is only half the pond, mm-hmm. because it will double again and completely cover the pond in the 30th day.
And this is why we don't worry.
The lesson here is that a long history of exponential growth does not imply a long future of exponential growth, that it catches you very much by surprise as you start shooting through barriers. And this is sort of what's happened to the world. And people are waking up to the surprise now, but the growth is still going on very, very rapidly. In California, for example, we had fewer than 20 million people when I went there 30 years ago. We have well over 30 now. We're going to have over 50 million people by 2020 unless something changes, and that's roughly the number of people that lived in Germany. So now.
Huh. And this is if we look at the planet, it's exponential growth that has brought us from 3.5 billion to 5 billion in short of 30 years.
Let me give you some. Population's a numbers game, okay? 4 million years ago, roughly, there was Lucy and her friends, the first small-brained upright ancestors, the first small-brained upright humans. If you don't count small-brained upright organisms as human beings, then of course there's some famous talk show hosts and some university professors who wouldn't be human. So let's call them human back there 4 million years ago, Homo afarensis, Lucy and her friends. Mm-hmm. Maybe a few hundred or a few thousand people. It took until the time I was born to increase that few hundred or a few thousand to 2 billion people. When I was born in 1932, there were about 2 billion people in the world. Population bomb, 1968, 3.5 billion. Here we are. I'm back in Fairbanks for the first time in about 30 years. Mm-hmm. 1994, 5.6 billion people. That is, to me, a blink of an eye. Somebody my age, 1968, wasn't that long ago. It's 25 years roughly. Mm-hmm. In that time, we have added more people to the planet, 2.1 billion people. We've added 100 million more people to the planet than existed when I was born. It took 4 million years to add the first 2 billion. And since 1968, we've added more than 2 billion more. That's exponential growth. Before we go through, sometime around the year 2000, we'll go through 6 billion. If I'm really unlucky, I might live to see the world more than double in my lifetime. More than triple in my lifetime.
This is Paul Ehrlich. The first book was The Population Bomb. The most recent, The Population Explosion. There have been something like 30 in between, authored and co-authored by.
My wife writes them, and I put my name on them.
His wife is Ann Ehrlich, who is a senior researcher at Stanford University. Paul Ehrlich is also with Stanford University, where he is a professor and researcher. Paul Ehrlich, our guest today on Conversations. Tell me about carrying capacities. People will say, Paul, as long as we can provide food for everybody, and if we can sort out what we think of as faulty distribution problems, so there's more food in Somalia than there is today, and we use a little less, and things balance out, there shouldn't be a problem, and that your views are alarmist.
Well, my views are alarmist because I, and frankly all of my colleagues, are alarmed. I mean, within the last year, 58 academies of science, including the U.S. National Academy, the British Royal Society, and every other significant academy of science on the planet, said we're in deep trouble because of population growth. 1,500 of the world's leading scientists, including more than half of all the world's Nobel laureates, said the same thing. We're alarmed. Why are we alarmed? Well, actually, you brought up the reason. It's a question of carrying capacity. Carrying capacity, technically, is the number of animals that you can keep in an area without their presence degrading the capacity of that area to support a similar number of animals or more in the future. Mm-hmm. It's not a very complicated, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand it. If you have a pasture and you put, it's a small pasture and you put 2,000 sheep on it, they may be able to feed for a couple of weeks, but if you're going to exceed the carrying capacity, the grass is going to be eaten, and then the next generation of sheep is not going to have anything to eat.
Okay.
So right now, we are far beyond the carrying capacity of the planet. How do we know that? It's very simple. With 5.6 billion people, we are not able to take care of more than about 1.2 billion in anything like the lifestyle the average Alaskan would like to live. Those are the numbers that live in the so-called rich countries. We're only able to do that and maintain another 4.1 billion in relative poverty by using up resources which will have to be which will be needed by future generations. In other words, we're not able to live on interest. We're only able to support 5.6 billion people because we're living on capital. Mm-hmm. And what are the most important parts of that capital? Our rich agricultural soils. That's why the United States is a great nation, because of the rich soils of the Middle West. They're about half gone. If you go to a place like Haiti, they're virtually all gone. Or Rwanda, a very good example. When I was in Rwanda some years ago, they were already farming right up to the tops of the hills, and all of the rivers were chocolate covered because of all the soil washing off of the over-fertilized, Hold on, I talk too fast too much. Yeah, come on.
You're fine. Hit me. I just put the quick injection is this is the same as the cows eating the field.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. Well, we're same thing as with our fossil groundwaters. The biggest aquifer in the United States is the Ogallala. It underlies the high plains. It's what makes if when you fly down to the lower 48 and go to the East Coast, you fly over these circular irrigation patterns in eastern Colorado and western Kansas, western Nebraska, places like that. And that's water being pumped out of the ground. The trouble is that we're pumping the water in the southern part of the Ogallala out at feet per year, and it's recharged at fractions of an inch per year. Mm-hmm. All over the planet, we're using up fossil groundwater and in the process destroying, in many cases, the capacity of the aquifers even to recharge. And then finally, we're using up our biodiversity. There's a campaign here in Alaska right now to, as I understand it, clear-cut huge areas of forest. Well, unfortunately, those huge areas of forest are very important to humanity over the entire planet. We tend to be chopping down our forests, and that's one of the reasons we're so concerned about climate change. Not because it might not be a little better for Alaska if it warmed up some, but unfortunately, it wouldn't be better for Alaskans, because there's a very good chance that if the planet's climate changes rapidly, it won't be warming everywhere. It'll be a mix of warming and cooling. But if the climate changes rapidly, of course, it's going to hurt agricultural production. And Alaska is one of the places in the United States where food prices are already high. In the U.S., disasters for agriculture will probably mostly be reflected in great increases in food prices. Over much of the rest of the world, of course, it'll be reflected in increases in death rates. And some people will starve in the United States, too, because some people are marginal in terms of their food, even in the United States.
Okay, before we get to this larger question, which is what is the worst that can happen, and I will ask you that, I want to ask you about human ingenuity, because I know there are people watching or listening now who are saying, look, we have solved terrible problems in our time as human beings, especially since the Renaissance. Look what we've done.
We're very ingenious. Look what we have done. I mean, we have managed to get the planet stocked with this huge number of people and keep most of them alive. So in some sense, we've been very clever. We forget about the Tigris and Euphrates valleys and the Mayan all the civilizations that really ruined their ecological life support systems and then disappeared. The thing that's different today is we have a global society that is ruining its life support systems. And when it disappears, there's not going to be any, other places to thrive. But Again, one of the very few advantages of getting older is you can get a historical perspective on these things. When the population bomb was written, again in 1968, when it came out, a whole bunch of people said, not to worry. Science, with a capital S, has got this wonderful ingenuity. There will be no problem at all giving food, housing, clothing, airplanes, automobiles, rich lives, education, and so on to 5 or 10 or 15 billion people. They said it, no, not to worry. Okay, we've run the test. We've added 2.1 billion people to the planet. Almost all of them have been added to the poor, to the ranks of the poor, not to the ranks of the rich. Mm-hmm. We aren't supplying everybody with a wonderful life. We lose about 10 million people a year to starvation. I would say again today what I said in 1968. When people said that, Ann and I said, okay, maybe science with a capital S will perform all these miracles. Why don't we stop, let science perform its miracles and give 3.5 billion people a really wonderful life? Then, if there's some reason, if somebody can think of a good reason to have more than 3.5 billion people alive on the planet at one time, they can be produced very rapidly by unskilled labor that enjoys its work. You don't have to worry about being able to have more people. Say the same thing to the same imbeciles today. If you think that science is going to, with a capital S, is going to let us take care of 10 billion people, why don't we stop at 5.6 and see if science can take care of 5.6 before we go running on to 10? And then if there's a reason, once again, they can be produced very easily. The fact is that the people who expect science with a capital S to take care of us are not the scientists. Again, if you listen to the academies of science, you listen to the most distinguished scientists in the world, they all say that's nonsense. But if you listen to Rush Limbaugh, distinguished scientist that he is, or a bunch of other people I could name, they're the ones who are saying not to worry. It's the what me worry syndrome. You saw them all in Mad Magazine.
Paul Ehrlich is our guest on Conversations. He is the Bing scholar, the Bing professor of population biology at Stanford University. He's been with Stanford since 1959, am I right
there? Yeah, a long time.
Long time.
I went there as a 2-year-old in the faculty.
Very young man. He's still a very young man. Our guest is the author, once again, of The Population Bomb and The Population Explosion. These two books bracket many others. He has co-written a book called The Race Bomb, which is how population and race intersect for a particular kind of tragedy. He's written a book on the machinery of nature. He's written a book with, let me think who this one is, Robert Ornstein,
yeah,
which I hope we'll discuss while we're together, called New World, New Mind, about the attitudes that shape overpopulation and the attitudes that may bring overpopulation to an end, help us reduce the population on the planet. With us today, Paul Ehrlich, this is Conversations. I said to a friend, Paul Ehrlich says that what we call natural disasters of our time are related to population, that acid rain and climate change and more hurricanes in Florida and flooding in the Midwest all have to do with overpopulation. And he rolled his eyes.
You want to know why?
Yeah, I want you to talk to him.
Well, there are two ways, actually. There's a cause way and there's an effect way. Let me talk about the effect way first, because it's the most obvious. I just saw in the news the other day that there is yet another typhoon going up the Bay of Bengal and killing millions of people or hundreds of thousands of people in Bangladesh. This happens every few years. The point is that Bangladesh has so many people that many of them are forced to live exposed out on the so-called chars, which are sandbars that come from the washing of soils out of the Himalayas and form in the delta of the Ganges River there. And these are only a foot or so above high tide, and they have to farm them because they don't have land elsewhere. And every time there's basically a hurricane, we would call them hurricanes, with a storm surge, it washes over the chars and it kills huge numbers of people. Mm-hmm. If there were fewer people, they proportionally would lose many fewer people in Bangladesh. That is because people would live and farm on the high ground and not live in precarious, exposed positions. So that's and this, by the way, isn't just Bangladesh. Should you visit a primitive city in the United States close to where I live called San Francisco, you will see many, many people living on fill in San Francisco Bay. During the 1907 earthquake, the little bit of fill there was described as looking like a blanket being tossed. If we have another big earthquake in San Francisco, proportionately we will lose many, many more people because people are living on fill in the bay. People are living, I have a wonderful picture in a textbook that Ann and I and a colleague wrote, of the jagged edge of the coastline near San Francisco with subdivisions built out onto the teeth of the saw. basically. And the notches in the saw are where landslides, where pieces of the coast dropped into the ocean in previous earthquakes. Well, if you had a reasonable sized population, nobody but a total idiot would live in one of those positions. So there is a, first of all, an effect. That is, natural disasters kill not just more people, but proportionately more people when you have overpopulation, because people are forced to live in precarious, exposed positions. Now, the other connection is even simpler. The population problem is not just the number of people you have, it's the number of people multiplied times their per capita impact, how much they impact on the environmental systems. Mm-hmm. It turns out that about 70% of the impact on environmental systems comes from the a little over 1 billion people in the rich countries. Only about 30% of it comes from the somewhat over 4 billion people in the poor countries. But everybody who burns anything, for instance, contributes carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is one of the greenhouse gases which is being increased in its concentration and is going to cause the climate to change ever more rapidly. If you only had half as many people, but they still continued to have the same behavior, the same per capita behavior, you would only have half as much carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere. If you only had half as much people and the other behavior did half as many people and the other behavior didn't change, you would only have half as much of the chlorofluorocarbons that are destroying the ozone layer going into the atmosphere. Now, the ozone layer is a non-trivial thing. We couldn't have life on land until we had an ozone layer. The ultraviolet radiation that it screens out from the sun is so poisonous that until about 400 million years ago, life had to hide in the sea. It wasn't until enough oxygen was produced in the sea to make an ozone layer possible that our ancestors in the form of amphibia and plants and insects managed to scramble out on the land and survive there. So again, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. If you have twice as many people, unless you have dramatic changes in behavior, twice as many people are going to do twice as much environmental damage by definition. Anybody who doesn't understand that ought to go back to grade school for some remedial arithmetic.
Do you think, where do you think we are in terms of climate change now?
Nobody knows for sure because there's a lot of uncertainty in the system. Most climatologists believe that we have detected a so-called warming signal. That is, the models are one thing, but the actual climatic records indicate that there has been about a degree Fahrenheit, roughly, warming over the last century, maybe a little more than that, a little less than a degree centigrade.
Six to eight is a disaster? Is that where
nobody knows where the problem is that the climatic system, as far as can be told, this is not my area of expertise, but I associate very closely with people who deal with this all the time. As far as you can tell from the climatic, from the records of climate, from ice cores and things like that, climate doesn't shift slowly. It shifts quite rapidly from one sort of quasi-stable state into another one. And so nobody has a real clue as to what's going to happen, except if we keep adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, we will change the climate. It will change in ways that are generally unpredictable, and it's going to probably be at least a decade before we can say too much about actual regional changes. Most of the models indicate, for example, there'll be drying in the centers of the big continents. If that occurs, of course, those are our breadbaskets, and that's really bad news. It's also not going to be a case of having winners and losers. It's not going to be one deal of the cards. The change is going to be continual. So the idea of saying, well, not to worry, some places will get worse for agriculture, but other places will get better, that's partially true, but of course the change is going to be continuous, and farmers are conservative. They're not going to just pick up the farmers in Iowa that are now growing corn in some of the richest land in the world are not all going to pack up and move to Ontario to grow corn. Curiously enough, if the climate band that's suitable for growing corn moves north, it may very well move, for instance, into Hudson Bay, where it's going to be tough to grow corn. But even if it doesn't get into Hudson Bay, it'll be on the Canadian Shield, and the soils won't be suitable for growing corn. Now, if you wait maybe 50,000 years with a corn-growing climate in that area, then soils might develop that would be useful, but then you have 50,000 years of living on what's in the grocery store, and that's not really going to last that long. So basically, the big threat from climate change is a threat to agriculture. And nobody can be sure what's going to happen, but one of the things that always impresses me is if we build an airplane like a 747, which I'm a pilot, I like to fly. I like to fly on 747s because they're a design that goes back through the 707 and through the old Boeing tankers. They're a well-tried design. They have four completely separate hydraulic systems, each one of which is capable of running all of the controls. So if you lose three hydraulic systems, you're still flying. That's nice. Now, Suppose you took a load of congressmen and flew them out of Dulles Airport in Washington for San Francisco, and the pilot came on and said, well, three of our hydraulic systems are out, and we're a little worried about the fourth, but we're going to try and make it to San Francisco. I suspect those congressmen would riot and insist on an immediate landing, because they want fail-safe design. But when it comes to the entire planet, to the life support system of the entire planet, you will see idiots in Congress and elsewhere stand up and say things like, well, we can't prove that rapid climate change is going to ruin agriculture and cause billions of people to die. Therefore, we got to go on and run the test. Well, why don't they take the same approach with the 747? Let's try and fly to San Francisco. We'll see if the other hydraulic system goes out. If we can prove that it's going to crash, you know, then we'll worry about it. We don't have any fail-safe attitude towards what we do with our lands, with what we do with our waters, with what we do with our forests in Alaska. Why not clear-cut most of Alaska? Let's see what happens. And well, what do you do for your reenactment? How do you replace the salmon populations, the fish populations, the bird populations, and so on, if you find out it wasn't a good idea to clear-cut huge areas? Where are you going to get the soil to restore the forests and so on after you've cleared them off and the runoff has, you know, taken the soil away and so on? We need a fail-safe approach to our spaceship Earth. Otherwise, we're just going to ruin it.
We're moving into the worst, what the worst is that can happen, and I think that's very
good. Into the real cheery part.
The real cheery part. I think it's good because you're giving us your long-term perspective. This is Paul Ehrlich with us today on Conversations. I want to ask you about public health issues. In, I don't know what the span of years were, but after World War II, World War I, there was an influenza epidemic that was worldwide. 21 million people died. Looking back, that's an incredible number to have died after World War I from an illness. You hold, again, in the population explosion, that we're setting ourselves up for public health disasters. And I wanted just to bring up a couple of resurgent illnesses to you and ask you if you think that's what's happening. Tuberculosis is back. We thought, the medical system in the United States thought it was
gone
20 years ago. Malaria is back and climbing in third world countries. AIDS is knocking Africa for a loop. Are these all population, and is influenza, which seems to mutate constantly?
There's a lot of ties here, and they're really interesting. We biologists have been concerned for a long time about this. One issue is that of emergent new diseases, particularly emergent viruses. And in the population bomb, again, we had a number of near misses by 1968, things called Marburg virus and Yangyang fever and Lassa fever and so on, all of which had enormous potential for hitting humanity hard, but we lucked out on. And one of the funny things is that we said, you got to watch out for new emergent viruses. And then, of course, along came AIDS, which has now formed a colossal worldwide epidemic, which Americans don't even appreciate the seriousness of. We have somewhere between 1 in 2 million Americans are HIV positive. Nobody knows exactly what the number is because we've been treating it mostly as a civil rights problem rather than a public health problem. Probably going to cost about $200,000 a person. They're all going to die. In all probability, the chances of surviving with AIDS essentially are zero now, and there's not much on the horizon for changing those chances. And it depends on how much it spreads. But that's a huge public health disaster in the United States, let alone in places like Africa, where they're expecting countries that were supposed to be doubling their populations every 25 years in the first part of the next century to be shrinking because of AIDS. And that doesn't even count in the social effects. That's only frank deaths from AIDS. That's not the breakdown of society that leads to other deaths.
No mother, no father, no grandparents.
And also the people in those societies that are most infected are the truck drivers, the politicians, the attorneys, the people that keep the society going. But this is all population connected for a number of reasons. One is that many diseases can't become epidemic in human beings till you have populations of a certain size. One of the things that we're doing is pushing large populations into closer and closer contact with animals that carry diseases in places like Africa. So that, for instance, couldn't have measles as an epidemic till you had something like 100,000 people at least put together in groups. So as you put larger groups into contact with disease reservoirs, you are setting yourself up for diseases to transfer into the human population. Then you have a huge monoculture of human beings. Larger and larger population, more and more in absolute numbers of people who are badly fed and therefore are immune compromised and are ideal targets for disease, and you have rapid transport systems. Many of you may have seen read the book by Randy Schultz or the band played on or seen the TV movie. Remember, it was patient number 8, I think it was, that airline steward who had managed to infect people on 6 continents.
He called him patient zero. Oh,
patient zero, whatever he was. But anyway, in 1750, if a plague ship left China for England, nobody died in England because everybody died on the ship before it got there. Nowadays, you can take disease carriers around the world very rapidly and spread diseases. So that's one aspect of the population situation. So the second, the resurgent malaria and TB and so on is related to a mistake that we're now continuing to make around the world. It was a mistake made with full foreknowledge by other people by the medical profession in broadcast use of antibiotics. We, as biologists, told them, this is the people who are dying now of TB and malaria and a lot of other diseases are in large part a victim of creationists. The creationists kill people. They don't realize it. But the reason is that the average American has no understanding of evolution. Anybody who understands how evolution works, and by the way, the teaching of evolution in American high schools is worse today than it was in 1925, even though we know a million more times more about the subject because of the creationists. But when you try and beat off your enemies by a broadcast use, by just loading up with antibiotics against bacteria, with things like chloroquine and so on against the protozoa that cause malaria, with things like DDT against insects, with herbicides, what you're guaranteeing is that the organisms will become resistant and more difficult to kill. And biologists from 1945 on in particular have been arguing very strongly to limit the use of antibiotics until you really need them. To use one for a while and then have a moratorium and don't use it at all for a long time and then come back with another one, but only use the other one in the most critical cases. Biologists have argued hard for integrated control against insects in our crops. We don't save any more of our crops now than we did in 1920. And we're having actually bigger and bigger problems, not just with the pests that become resistant, but the insecticides we use kill off the enemies of other insects that then become pests. The pesticide industry actually creates pests. Spider mites, which were never a problem, essentially, in agriculture around the world, are now problems in many, many areas that the creation of DDT. Until we had DDT to kill off their insect predators, the spider mites were never a problem. Now they're a problem, and the pesticide industry makes miticides, which are even more carcinogenic and kill off other things. These mistakes are transparent. They were predicted. Sorry.
No, it's fine. Paul Ehrlich is with us on this edition of Conversations. We're talking about population, overpopulation, its consequences, its effects, and our future. This is Conversations. I don't want you to leave any of this. So
that's all right. As we start running towards a break, you just start getting looking more and more nervous, and I know what's happening, and I was trying to talk faster and faster.
Fill that space up.
Yes, right. No dead air.
Go back to the creationists, because I'm sure you've left some people with their mouth open. You're speaking of a way of thinking, an attitude about what life is, and an attitude about science or biology that you think is cutting us off from our wisdom.
Well, it not only cuts us off from very practical problems, it means that we have too many people, including physicians, who don't understand what's happening with the antibiotic system, for example, and too many farmers who are not fully aware of the inevitable consequences of the way we use herbicides and pesticides and so on. But it also cuts us off from any knowledge of our roots, from understanding of ourselves. In other words, it is insane not to teach what is known about modern evolutionary theory in all of our schools, just starting grade school. Now people say, oh, evolution is just a theory. They don't understand that that's a scientific term, theory. It's also just a theory that the Earth is round and that it actually goes around the sun and not vice versa.
Give me a quick definition of theory so we know.
A theory is something where all of the present facts that have been gathered, facts being like the number of teeth in your head, things that everybody can agree on and so on, that all of the facts that have been gathered do not falsify, do not show to be wrong, okay? The theory that the Earth is round is pretty well supported by photographs putatively taken from spaceships. The theory that the Earth goes around the sun is supported by all the data when you do all calculations of orbits, but nobody's ever seen the Earth go around the sun, and so on. The theory that organisms today evolved from other organisms in the past, and that in the fossil record, the things you see are remains of previous organisms. That's as close to a fact as any science. That's as close to a fact as that the Earth goes around the sun, or that the Earth is actually spherical. But There are disagreements in the scientific community about the actual mechanisms of evolution. But there are, for example, abundant so-called missing links and so on. We have an incredibly graded series of human beings, for example. I mean, minor differences in the shape of the head and so on. They can't even decide exactly where each one goes. I mean, the idea that somebody should bring their religious beliefs forward and propose that they be taught in our public schools is simply nonsensical. But if it was nonsensical, that would be bad enough, but it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. It gives people crazy ideas about human behavior, about what human beings are all about where we come from and so on, and it gives us crazy ideas about how to deal with our competitors and our predators, and as a result, it ends up in dead people. I mean, it is not harmless.
Okay. Paul Ehrlich with us on Conversations. Let me take a look at some of the awards. There are many awards. Just in 1993, he was given the International Center for Tropical Ecology World Ecology Medal and the Volvo Environmental Prize. But for 1990 to 1995, he is on a MacArthur Prize Fellowship. In 1991, Distinguished Service Citation from the University of Kansas, his alma mater, and a Major Achievement Award from the New York City Audubon Society. There are many and diverse awards for his work on his own and his work with his wife, companion, and research associate, Anne Ehrlich, who is also responsible for a good deal of the writing, as he says, all the writing, of their books jointly written. This is Conversations. I want to stay on the subject of attitude and move to the book that you wrote with Robert Ornstein called New World, New Mind. You said in that book that, let me think if I can get the paraphrase as close to right as possible, that the world is an increasingly dangerous place on which to live, and that we are ill-equipped to understand those dangers because of our not just cultural heritage, but our biological heritage. This may be a good springboard for attitudes of today. Can you explain that statement?
Yeah, it again goes back to both our biological and our cultural evolution, and you can understand it easily if you just think about that. I mean, after all, we're a very recent event, people like us, after all. Cities, farming and cities and so on, only 10,000 years old. And we're talking about a history of things that we would consider to be human of at least 4 million, maybe 5 million years. So for most of humanity's existence and for the billions of years of the existence of life, we have developed certain mechanisms to deal with our environment. And for humanity's existence, some of these mechanisms, more and more of these mechanisms, are cultural rather than genetic. And one of the things, for example, that's interesting to think about is to start way back, is our, in an evolutionary perspective, is our worldview. It's very much shaped by the fact that we once lived in trees and had to jump from branch to branch. And that's why we're largely visual animals. That is, we don't smell our environment primarily. We see it. Why do we see it? Well, if anybody's ever been a tree and tried to smell the next branch before they jump to it, you can find out why the branch smellers tended to end up on the forest floor dead, and the branch seers ended up reproducing and passing on the seeing genes. Well, what does it mean that we're largely sight animals? It means we tend to ignore and not be able to detect many of the cues in our environment that come from odor. Your dog is the other way around. Your dog can almost tell what you're thinking by smelling what's going on. If we could do that, for example, lots of forms of chemical contamination of our environment would probably be much more real to us and we would be much more concerned. But we tend to be more concerned with cigarette butts in our environment, which we can see, than with a thin film of poison on our fruit, which we can't, neither can see, nor can we detect it with our sense of smell as we could if we were smell animals. So, I'm only making that point to show you that accidents of our evolutionary history, the fact that we spent time in trees, actually affects our perception of environmental contamination today. Now, the thing that we wrote about most in New World, New Mind is that for almost all of our history, there was no reason for us to be able to perceive changes in our environment that went on over periods of decades. We're very good at detecting sudden changes. We, for example, if a car swerves towards us from the other lane, we react instantly. Just like if the cave bear appeared in the door of the cave, we learned to react instantly. But if the climate started to change, what could Australopithecus or Homo erectus or even our ancestors 10 generations back do about it? The answer is nothing. There was never any reason to detect an ability to detect changes in the environment that went on slowly. In fact, quite the opposite. We have been selected, as far as we can tell, to keep the background environment still, even when it's not still, to make the environmental backdrop against which we lead our lives appear to be constant. If you don't believe this, you can run an experiment at home. If you move your head like this, the room doesn't move at all. It just stands there. Your head moves, but the room doesn't move. If you take your video camera and go like this, and then watch the tape, you'll get seasick. Why is that? Because your brain keeps the room in still because it can tell your head is moving, and you get feedback from your moving head, and that corrects the image the room says stays still. If you move your TV, your video camera like that, and then show it, your brain, when you look at it, isn't telling you that the video camera is moving, and you see it blur. If you're sitting down now, you probably don't realize that you are getting messages from your behind that tell you you're sitting. But when I tell you that, you will then detect the messages coming. The point is, as you sit down, when your butt hits the chair, you get those messages, you know you're there, you relax your legs, you're sitting. But then, because it's constant, you tune it out. We tune out constant signals. We think things are, we just ignore the things that are at most changing slowly. Your butt may be getting a little bit more tired, but you ignore that sort of thing. And so basically, we are not adapted to dealing with the kinds of changes that we see in the environment, the little increase in carbon dioxide in the air, the gradual disappearance of the forests and so on, the slow, from our perception, growth of the human population are things it's easy for us to ignore.
This is Paul Ehrlich. This makes sense to me, and it kind of answers it's not really a question, but we hear that it's a failure of compassion and a failure of an unwillingness to give up what we have that keeps us from responding to the needs of the planet. And you're saying, no, it's much deeper than that and different.
Yeah, I don't think it's a failure of compassion at all. For instance, the average American, when they see a picture of a kid in Africa starving to death, well, they want to run a rock concert, they want to send food, they get that, and that's the kind of thing we can react to. Mm-hmm. If somebody shows you a chart of the growth of the human population, first of all, our school systems are so lousy that most people can't relate to charts to begin with, but it's like, you know, this was where it was in 1920, 30, 40, you know, it's such a gradual thing that it doesn't come at you. It's only, where do people suddenly get excited? It's when there's a disaster, Bhopal, you know, where something like that, I think it was 10 or 20,000 people were killed or badly injured immediately in a chemical spill, or Exxon Valdez. I mean, if you go to the Keys of Florida, the rocks are all covered with oil. There are many places that the oceans are getting totally screwed up. They're the ultimate sink. But it's mostly from washing out of fuel bunkers and so on. Gradually, little bits are added here. They still dump garbage and plastic. You go up to the Pribilofs. The shore is lined with plastic junk, but each one is just, you know, it's accumulation of plastic junk thrown off of fishing ships for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's only when you get that dramatic thing, the Exxon Valdez, you know, that wonderful Exxon tanker captain driving himself up on a reef. Suddenly, it's a story. I mean, I'm in the media, you're in the media. It changes something which is background into a sudden event, and we focus on the events. We don't focus on the gradual erosion of both the quality of our life, and I'm convinced that the quality of the average American's life has gone way downhill since 1950, in spite of our higher GNP, in spite of our more gadgets, and certainly the life support capacity of the planet has gone downhill as well. We don't register on them, only on the big disasters.
Okay, now tell me about big disasters in terms of cultural and biological history. If we look at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we learned instantly what the danger of an atomic weapon applied directly was. And yet, the arms race went on forever afterwards.
But it went on gradually. People were not aware of the buildup of the... I mean, we got to something like 50,000 nuclear warheads when anybody who did the simplest analysis knew that something like a dozen or two Hiroshima-sized bombs would totally destroy either the United States or the Soviet Union. There were people who had an interest in doing it, and the accumulation was gradual. And people, by the way, who criticized, I mean, very famous incident occurred here at the University of Alaska some years ago. One of the most idiotic things ever planned was to blow up a hydrogen bomb, ruin half of Alaska, and to make a new harbor up on the northern coast.
Project Chariot was to make a harbor at Point Hope.
And remember... two biologists at the University of Alaska said this is an idiotic idea, and that was understating it. And what happened to them? The moronic president of the University of Nebraska fired them. Now, that's the kind of thing that happened when people tried to warn of what was going to happen. Then they got themselves shut down.
The question I want to lead us to is a question of responsiveness. When I think about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, those alive and mature at that age watched that happen, and yet the responsiveness long-term didn't happen. If we look at Bhopal, immediately there were solutions applied to the immediate problem, but not long-term.
But there are significant things. First of all, one of the problems we have in this world is a whole series of isms that make it difficult for us to deal with our problems properly, like sexism, racism, religious prejudice, and so on. In the Second World War, and I'm old enough to remember it, the average person, including myself, was relieved by Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I was 14 years old or something. We were fighting this horrible war. People that I knew were getting killed. The Nazi death camps were coming forth. And here was a way to end all the suffering. It was predicted that, you know, millions of Americans would be killed invading Japan. And after all, it was only Japanese. And at that time, we'd been taught that Japanese were hardly human. That's what you always do with the enemy. Mm-hmm. So, and it's the same thing. Bhopal, if Bhopal had occurred in say, Missouri, there'd have been a very different reaction to the behavior of the chemical industry in the United States. But after all, those are, quote, only Indians. And the, I can't remember the bomb. I never remember the name of the Bomb Harbor Project. But after all, the people who were most threatened there were immediately threatened were a bunch of Inuit. But fortunately, people got behind that, and that was enough of a thing to stop it. But it's very easy to write off it's very easy to bear other people's suffering with a stiff upper lip. And I think the one really big problem is partially being solved by television, but not enough, is to get us empathetic with other people. It does work sometimes when you really say, this business in Rwanda. I think Americans are enormously, enormously empathetic about that, but they don't know what to do. And it's not easy to know what to do. It's really it's a continuation of the problems we've had ever since we developed nation states and sort of turned the world over to men and the military. And we got to think hard about how we have an opportunity now with the big power confrontation ended surprisingly rapidly, which is one of the things that makes me cheery. In other words, if you ask me how I can be optimistic, it is, if you told me 5 years ago that you thought that the big power confrontation was going to end within 5 years, I'd have said you're crazy, and so would have most other people. Yeah. I mean, when the time is ripe, things can change rapidly, but we ought to think very hard about nation states, about why what's happening in places like Bosnia and Herzegovina and so on are going on, about why people should be fighting over all of these things, because among other things, there's going to be more and more to fight over in the future. We've had one war over water in the Middle East in 1967. Can another be far behind? We have to really deal not just with problems of how people relate to the environment, but how they relate to each other as well.
Paul Ehrlich graduated from the University of Pennsylvania in 1953. He went on to earn an MA in 55 from the University of Kansas and his PhD in 1957, also from the University of Kansas. He went on within 2 years to begin work at Stanford. He's now the Bing Professor of Population Studies there and has been such since 1977, has been the Bing Professor since 1977 with Stanford since 59, a professor of biological sciences. And we're talking today about population. Let's get to, if we can turn this around, how we turn this around, and as we move along, kind of what you expect of you and me and people listening today. What's the best thing about human beings in terms of overpopulation?
The best thing about human beings is we're enormously adaptable. It's the worst thing, too. In other words, we learn in Los Angeles they became so adaptable they say things like, well, we like to see the air we breathe. That's one problem. On the other hand, to reduce our impact on the planet, we have to do three things. We have to reduce the number of people eventually. We have to reduce the amount each person consumes. And we have to improve the technologies that service the consumption. And all of those can be done with a higher quality of life if we have the political will. when it comes to limiting the population and getting it slowly shrinking, all we really need in places like the United States is some government leadership to say things like, patriotic Americans, stop it too. United States is still growing like a skyrocket. We're the most overpopulated nation in the world when you consider our consumption too. Mm-hmm. We're the third largest in numbers. We have more than a quarter billion people in the United States now, which is more than 100 million more than anybody has ever come up with even a half-baked idea why, you know, what advantage we would have to having alive at one time. We consume, our unit of consumption per person is about 12. The average rich person is about, I'm talking in energy terms, so I won't give you the units, but we're about 12. The average rich person is about 7.5. The average poor person in a poor country, about 1. We could get down to 3, and the poor countries could come up to 3, and our quality of life could improve. The sort of thing that would be involved would be redesigning our cities around people instead of automobiles, so that almost everybody could bike or walk to work. I think almost everybody would consider that an enormous increase in the quality of their life. And there are people in the Los Angeles basin who drive 2 hours a day with their friends and other cars shooting at them in order to be grocery sackers. It'd be much better to redesign our cities around people. And we could have very rich lives at about a third to a quarter of our present energy consumption. What's needed is political and social will and education for people to understand, you know, what their options are. Because when you ask, how many people can say the United States support or can the world support? One of the questions you have to answer is, what kind of lifestyle? Everybody wants to be a vegetarian saint. You can support more people than if everybody wants to be a Hollywood mogul and have 6 cars. Mm-hmm. And what kind of lifestyle isn't a scientific decision, it's a social decision.
What do you say to a West African man who says, my wealth is counted in my cattle and the number of babies my wife provides me? Or to a Catholic person who says it's morally unacceptable to stop a conception from happening and a birth from happening?
Well, to the West African, I say, it depends. If you want to live the way West Africans always lived when they counted their wealth in the number of children, then you shouldn't use things like antibiotics or try and westernize to do the things that normally used to kill off most of your children, so the number
so
of children you had.
Right,
exactly.
Right.
I wouldn't have to say anything to the Catholic, because the average Catholic today performs reproductively exactly like the average Protestant or Jew around the world, essentially. The problem with is not a problem of Catholic performance. The smallest family sizes in the world, 1.3 children on the average, are in Italy and Spain. There is the Vatican has a very, very serious problem, and one simply has to ask whether a bunch of celibate old men ought to be dictating to young women and young men what they ought to do with their sex lives, particularly when in theory they have no experience with such things.
So matters of what we think of as official morals or ethics, or in the case of the West African man tradition, you think are not major issues?
They're extremely major issues, but you ask me what I would say to them. In other
words,
in other words, yes, the trouble is that we, for example, we intervened with modern technology. Maybe it was a good thing, maybe it was a bad thing, but we intervened with modern technology to lower the death rate, to make more children survive. In my view, if you do that, then you are morally committed to intervene to have fewer children, because otherwise you will wreck the carrying capacity of the planet, and you're putting a huge price on future generations, which is inequitable. That is the numbers. What you can say scientifically is very simple, and that is anybody who is fighting to keep the birth rate up, to avoid reducing the birth rate, is automatically fighting to increase the death rate. That's arithmetic. In other words, you can't have an infinite population on a finite planet. So if you're working against using contraception, then you're automatically working for more babies eventually to die young.
This is all related to tuberculosis and malaria and hurricanes
and starvation and everything else. And so there is no way you can be moral and be fighting against contraception unless you're in favor of more babies dying.
Okay. Two countries with very large populations, China and India, have tried population control methods from in official doctrine and common practice. China has succeeded fairly well, and India has not succeeded. Can you give me a thumbnail analysis of what's happening?
Well, I think the Chinese come from a society in which very different from ours. I'm not saying better or worse, but where they emphasize social responsibility and we emphasize individual rights. And in my view, my own personal view would be to find something partway in between the two. But that helped a lot in China. There were some abuses by our standards and abuses by their standards. In fact, when the right wing in this country argues about the terrible abuses in China, the only way they know about it is that the Chinese literature, and I know personally the person, the scientist who was most responsible for pointing out to the Chinese government what was happening in terms of their resource population balance and so on, and has been very much involved in this, they considered them abuses too and went out to correct them. In a country with an average per capita income of something like $600 a year and with over 1.2 billion people, a poor country, to actually put in a program with so few abuses, I think was basically a wonderful thing. And though they haven't gotten the job entirely done, they've gone a long way towards preventing the huge famines that were inevitable, in their view, otherwise. India's had some success. They brought their average family size down from maybe seven to about four children over a period of time. But India is very diverse culturally. It hasn't got the same sort of traditions of social pressure and so on that China has, and I think has been much less successful in bringing up the average level of education of the women, of providing decent medical care. As when you think about, I don't want to talk too much about how one gets population size down in poor countries, because it tends to deflect from the fact that the U.S. is probably the worst offender. But if you think about how to do it in poor countries, the things that most people agree on is it's empowering women, giving decent education, giving access to means of birth control once you've educated, empowered, given decent health care, and so on. And the Chinese did very well on that. They gave quite good health care to their people. Better on average maybe than the United States. The high tech is available to you and me, but there are a lot of people in the United States who don't have access to any kind of decent health care. Same thing with food and everything else. The Chinese managed to supply, to empower their women to a great degree and to supply the health care. In India, there's still all kinds of things like child bride selling and so on going on. Women are still not in the kind of position they ought to be in India, and that's a critical thing. And the United States and other rich countries have not been have mucked around a lot more in India than they have in the United States. They have an agricultural system that was invented by U.S. agriculturalists that's utterly inappropriate to a large. A lot of the trouble in the Punjab, for example, and so on there is due to abuses introduced along with the Green Revolution, the so-called Green Revolution. It's a very complicated situation, but the two countries are very different.
Okay, now come home with me. I think it was Sierra Club put out a book some years ago and asked people like yourself and Anne to write on the subject. If I were king, if I had my way, what would I do?
I'd steal the money and go to Bora Bora.
Okay, this is where you'll find Paul Ehrlich in a couple of years. Rich, fat, and sassy. If you had absolute power over the United States, what would you do? And given absolute power or not, what would you recommend to us, to, again, people like you and me and people who are listening?
Well, I would, first of all, get the government fully behind a program that says patriotic Americans, stop it too. And then I would try and have a dialogue in the country over what parts of our consumption really matter to us. In other words, we don't want designer. In my view, the average American doesn't want a designer refrigerator replaced every couple of years. They want cold beer, and you know, designer refrigerators may not be the best way to get yourself cold beer. A lot of these decisions have to be made socially. A dictator is not going to manage. If you look at the environment in the Soviet Union, for example, or in Poland, you can see what happens when the government tries to run everything. What we have to do is try and get people to realize what their options are and then let society itself decide. We got to get the economists all thinking about issues like how you have a steady state economy. We know, every scientist in the world knows, that the economy can't grow forever. And so why aren't we looking closely, as some economists are beginning to, finally, and we're working with economists at Stanford, at how you transition to an economy that still keeps people, gives people a quality of life, but isn't growing. I mean, perpetual growth, after all, is the creed of the cancer cell. So if I were a dictator, all I would try and do is bring the issues to the forefront. But you're never going to win this game unless people are willing to cooperate with each other, unless they're willing to forget about, to suppress a lot of their differences of race, religion, sexism. All that stuff is going to have to be suppressed much more, because the solutions are going to have to be cooperative. We're going to have to learn to be a lot more empathic. And I think the way to do it is to show that everybody basically can have a better, higher quality, more joyous life. And they can learn to get more of their pleasure out of sex than out of gadgets, for example. And I think most people would enjoy that more.
Mm-hmm. So
you do not have to reproduce every time you have sex, right. They tell me.
They tell me. What's your, with, I don't know, maybe 3 minutes left, what's your sense of the world that is being given to your daughter who is grown and has daughters now? What, in the next two generations, what's...
At the moment, very much more deteriorated. A very much sadder world, living a much closer to both the biophysical limits of what the planet can support and also to the social limits of what the planet can support. If, however, I wanted to be cheery, I would say, again, I have seen incredible social transitions in my lifetime. If you had told me in 1945 that by 1975 the richest performer in the United States would be black and that there would be blacks in all professional sports and that there would be a big black middle class and so on, I would have said, not going to happen for 100 years. We haven't gone far enough in that area, but we did in the 60s, in late 50s and 60s, make incredible transitions. When I was first concerned about population issues in the 60s, the sociologist told me it would be beyond the end of the century if the government got behind it before we had two-child family or less in the United States. We got it in 1971. When the time is ripe, we can move very, very rapidly. My hope is, for my grandchildren in particular, is that we will start moving very rapidly in this entire area of population and consumption, and that our conversation today will, 10 years from now, seem like a piece of ancient history, that it's all, you know, been transitioned the same way a conversation 5 years ago about the confrontation with the Soviet Union has become ancient history today.
You said before we went to tape that you've been walking to work a mile and a half every day ever since you've been at Stanford. It's one of the reasons you stay at Stanford. What difference does one person walking to work every day make?
Oh, it takes a huge load off the planet. And one person having only one or two instead of three children takes a huge load off the planet, particularly if it's an American person. Because, again, the average American consumes something on the order of 30 times as much of the world's resources as the average person in a desperately poor country like Bangladesh. So by reducing our population size and reducing our consumption, the Americans are in a position to set a real example for the world, and we are widely imitated even though we're widely hated. So the more Americans who can walk to work and live relatively simple lives and be as efficient as they possibly can be while leading a quality life, that will set a standard for the rest of the world. We will be imitated. We don't want our consumption imitated.
Paul Ehrlich, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
This has been Conversations with Population Biologist Paul Ehrlich. If this conversation is intriguing to you, there are books still on the shelf since 1968. There are books just recently out, and I'll be bound there are undoubtedly going to be more. From Ballantyne in 1968, The Population Bomb. From Simon & Schuster in 1990, The Population Explosion. Either one or both will bring you up to date on Paul and now Ann Ehrlich's perspective on population. The Golden Door takes a look at immigration and population issues, especially in the United States, especially between Mexico and the southwestern states. Extinction, yes, you know what that's about. Eco-Science with John Holdren is a very big book on the subject. If you really want to dive in, perhaps Eco-Science with Ann Ehrlich, John Holdren, and Paul Ehrlich is the way to go. And that book with Robert Ornstein was New World, New Mind, about changing the way we view the world on which we live. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Thank you very much, Paul Ehrlich.
My pleasure.
I hope you join me again next week.